You're listening to the podcast of Williamsburg Christian Church, a community of faith joining God's pursuit of restoring lives. We hope you enjoy this week's podcast. So here's where I am, personally. I think that among the many problems our society has, we have at least two major problems. One, we have a society of broken trust. Trust is broken. We can't believe what we used to believe on the news anymore. We can't believe what we see on the internet and everything is there. I mean, you wouldn't be able to tell that we can't believe what we see on the internet. By the way, some of us share things. But that's another, probably another conversation, which lends to the broken trust, right? We can't even believe what we see anymore. I mean, in the world of being able to record things, right? Like years ago, a neighbor would have a conflict with a neighbor, years and years ago, and no one would ever know about it but the two neighbors. Now it's on YouTube, or it's some sort of 15-minute snippet, or it's been tweeted about 70 ways from Sunday. Matter of fact, decades upon decades ago, two countries could have a problem with each other. I'm not saying these are good or bad, I'm just saying the world has changed, and nobody would ever know. But now it's reported in a hot minute. I mean, you could isolate any kind of engagement, any kind of confrontation between two people. You could isolate the whole thing. You could record it an hour's worth, isolate 1 minute of it, put it out there, and it articulates something that actually didn't happen. On the flip side, you could isolate the same thing, and it did happen, but some of us are so ideologically formed that we can't see what really happened. Does that make sense? So, like, for example, I remember there's this one picture of Prince William. Now, I got this confused for, is it Prince Harry or Prince William? Both of them are handsome. Which one was the handsome, not redhead one? William, okay. So, Prince William. So, I have a problem. I realize I'm vain. That they, I always remember people by their handsomeness, particularly those guys. You're welcome, Bill. Which is why I don't think of Bill as much as I would, as I probably should. So there's William. Okay, so there's a scene where Prince William is getting out of the car and he's got a finger up and his finger's doing this. But if you look at it from one camera angle, it looks like he's flicking everybody off. But then when you look at the other camera angle, which is really funny that people took the picture from both sides, you can see he's just throwing up a number one. It's fascinating. What it comes down to is in a society of broken trust, we now are prone to see only what we want to see. Now, we always have been to some degree. But now we have the media. And by media, I don't mean just the media news stations. I'm talking about social media, internet. I'm talking about everything to kind of back it up. And I've come to believe that it's not so much what we see as it is the eyes that we bring to see it. I've come to believe that it's not so much what we hear as it is the ears that we bring to hear it. Now, I'm going to tell you, preaching and teaching in this kind of setting is the same way. Real life story. 7 years ago, I preached a sermon on God as judge, okay? And it was coming out of Amos. And I basically walked the church through a survey of Amos. And I thought about how God is a judge, and in his judgment, there are two types of justice. There's tzedakah and there's mishpat. Tzedakah being social justice, which is a biblical term, and mishpat being legal justice. And I talked about this for a long time. Now, it happened to be around the time that old Glenn Beck decided to tell every Christian and evangelical in the country that if your preacher ever uses the word social justice, he or she is just espousing a Barack Obama agenda, and you better leave quickly. Well, I had a couple of couples in our church take that very seriously. So later that day, I had somebody send me an email, and they stumped out and they said, "You're nothing but a socialist Barack Obama agenda-promoting preacher, and we're leaving the church." I was like, confused, because, true story, later on that afternoon, I got another email that said, you're nothing but promoting the Tea Party agenda, and we're leaving the church. I was confused, because it was the same sermon. So I sent my manuscript and asked that the podcast be put online ASAP and sent it to both of them and said, please, somebody explain. How does this happen? How is it that I preach the same sermon and not just have two hearers interpret it two different ways, but two opposing ways? And here's the kicker. You could say, well, Fred, was it the first? They were both in the same service. It was like a gift from God. Like, here's an example to stay in your head, Fred, forever, that people will want to hear what they want to hear. Okay, so let's be honest. Raise your hand if you've ever heard something from the pulpit, whether from me or from somebody else. You heard a point, and your mind got so triggered by that point that you stayed on that same point and missed everything that came afterwards. Raise your hand. I know you do it to Jason every time he preaches. No, really, like it happens, and that's what happens. We are so easily triggered. Say triggered. And we live in a society of broken trust where there's tons of trauma. Say trauma. There's societal trauma and there's individual trauma. And any time that societal trauma or that individual trauma enters into our lives, it creates triggers. And any time something that is said about a particular something that triggers that trauma, we then have now this experience. This experience is physiological even experience of pain. It's a pain we begin to feel. And that pain continues to trigger the traumas, which continues to perpetuate the broken trust. And so instead of listening to the other person for what they are, which is maybe somebody that we disagree with or maybe somebody that I know. Let's say it's somebody I know. These two couples, they knew me. They should have known better. They really should have. They should have known me. Instead of looking at it as somebody that you know and trusting that maybe this is a disagreement, but I trust his or her heart and I'm going to move through this, instead, the trauma gets triggered so much, the pain is so visceral that it creates an antagonism. Now the other person is an opponent. It's no longer a person, it's an opponent. It's no longer a person, it's he or she becomes an it, becomes a label. Liberal, conservative, whatever. And it allows us to dehumanize the other because we label them. And now we can treat them or do with them whatever we please. And even if it means walk away and act like they don't even exist. Our society is filled with this. It's a society of broken trust. Because even people we've been in lifelong relationships with, we can find them easily become an antagonist or an opponent to something I hold dear. And what is it that is provoking all this? I submit to you that I think above all things, it's fear. Because the Bible teaches that maturing love drives out what? Fear. But fear drives out what? Love. And so if fear is able to drive out love, I'm allowed then not to love the other. But here's what I would suggest. I would suggest that it's as much to do with the pain that the fear provokes, that it's pain. And we miss it. And none of us like to feel pain. Nobody wants to move through the pain of reconciliation, of pain of pushing through, the pain of having to sit still and listen to that nonsense. Nobody wants that. Nobody even wants to go through the pain of realizing that I bought into that snippet and I was wrong. Nobody wants to realize that I bought into that ideal and come to find out I was wrong. Nobody wants to move through the pain of these things. And this creates a second major problem, and the problem is the church. Because now what happens is the church isn't immune to any of this. We participate with it right along with the rest of society. Our little wars are just a little holier because we baptize them in the name of eternity. We draw lines in the sand and erect walls, and we push in and we push against. But we're not pushing in and pushing against the pain. We're pushing in and against others. And we're marginalizing others while welcoming others in to the exclusion of others. And we are driven by our fear and we're driven by our pains because at the end of the day, the church doesn't even want to suffer. And the irony of the church not wanting to suffer is that we just got through singing songs to the one that the scripture calls the suffering servant, who, whether we like it or not, calls us to a life that will always involve suffering. But instead, we see people not as they are, but for what we want to see them. Collins, when you were living through homelessness and you were walking down the streets of Williamsburg, were you ever called names by people? What were some of the names that you can say in church? Because I know there are some names you can't say in church. What else? Yep. And so instead of seeing his humanity and seeing him for who he is, people in our own city would see him walking down the street carrying a book bag and shout this stuff out. But don't think for one second that you haven't thought that about the people flying a sign on Monticello. And a lot of times what we fail to see is that it's our politics that make that happen. It's our ideology that puts them in that category because we're defending something. We would never see it that way, but we are. We are. We're overvaluing things. We would never say it that way, but we are. And so we can't enter into his pain because we're too blinded by our own pain. So instead of entering into his pain, our pain provokes us to see him as something that he's not. And that is a label. Or a bum. Or a freeloader. Rather than a beloved man who is known by God, who is loved by God, who is to be entered into and embraced with the hands and the heart and the mind and the eyes and the ears of God. Whereby not only may he find salvation, but are you ready for this? We might find salvation too. Where our pain might find healing by entering into his pain and sharing the pain together and together finding the suffering servant who, the scripture says, carried our pains. So Isaiah, standing up before Israel, sees Israel filled with broken trust, filled with brokenness, and he calls them out to see the promised Messiah, the King. And he says, he, the one who's to come, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of suffering who knew what sickness was. He was like someone people turned away from. He was despised and we didn't value him. Read this with me. Yet he himself bore our sickness and he carried our pains. Then I like this because this could be a whole other conversation on its own. But Isaiah then says, but we in turn regarded him stricken and struck down by God and afflicted. But he was pierced, not because God was enacting some divine child abuse. He was pierced. He was pierced because of our rebellion. He was crushed because of our iniquities. The punishment for our peace was on him. Read this with me. And we are healed by his wounds. We all went astray like sheep. We have all turned to our own way, and the Lord has punished him for the iniquity of us all. The Lord has entered in himself into our due punishment by entering into our suffering. The Lord refused to look at us and say, you did this to yourself, get yourself out of it. The Lord refused to look down on us as we crossed the streets and say, bum, freeloaders. He instead felt pain. God himself felt the pain of being disconnected from his beloved and entered into the pain and carried our pain so that we could be redeemed from our own self-inflicted pain. Now, lest we fall into some very bad theology of prosperity gospel, it's important that we let the Bible interpret itself. So Matthew has an interpretation of this Isaiah 53 text himself in Matthew 8 when he says in verse 16, when evening came, they brought to him, Jesus, many who were demon-possessed. He drove out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick so that what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. Read it with me. He himself took our weaknesses and carried our diseases. So what did Jesus do? All right, you ready? He did exactly what we know he did. He went to the sickness and the suffering. He entered into it. And he made it whole by entering into it and taking it upon himself, taking responsibility for the suffering of others, so that they could find life again. See, when Palestinian society saw a leper, what they saw was the physical infirmity. What they saw was the rotting of the bodies. What they could not see was the rotting of the heart. See, Jesus could have entered the physical bodies by touching. He could have said, hey, be healed, and they could have been healed. But that wasn't good enough for Jesus, because what Jesus knows is that the pains that we carry aren't always physical. They're the silent ones too. And the only way the silent suffering and the silent pains of a person find healing is when God himself enters into that silent suffering and touches the parts that no one can see. Sure, the man's physical healing was healed, but so was his heart. Why? Because when Jesus went to an excluded people and included them into life with God and paved the way for inclusion for them back into society, it is in that sense of belonging that healing was found, because that belonging was provoked by love. Collins, when you were engaged, when we went to you, when you came to us, when we came together, when you came to me as your SLC and to this church as a part of this ministry, what did you find? If we had just housed you and put you up in a house and then said, good luck with this, good, seriously, awesome, good, would that have been the same? Because what did you still need? We could have just fed him, could have given him a Starbucks gift card, could have put him in a house and said, woo, look at us, we house people. But that's not what he needed. Yes, that's what he needed. But what he needed was the pains that were inside to be touched and healed. And the only way that that could happen is to enter into it. Was it easy, bro? Was our journey together, mine and yours specifically, as SLF and Friend in Need, was it free of bumps and bruises? Was it easy? Did you and I kind of get after each other from time to time? Yeah. Were you always wrong? Just kidding, don't answer that. You see what I was doing there? Did I let you down? The answer is yes. Okay. Did this church sometimes let you down? Okay, so that's what happened in First Gathering. We didn't rehearse this. So I was like, Collins, did I ever let you down? And Collins was like, no. And I'm like, dude, no. Like, I know I did. I was like, did the church ever let you down? And he's like, well, no. And I said, I know we did. Here's what I learned from Colin, see. When the darkness is so dark, even a little ray of light looks like a blazing sun. And so even the most foul of mistakes that I made with Collins in my own heart and my own intent and things that I know we could have been more faithful to as a church was still a blazing sun for him. But for some of us, see, we live so much in the sort of a half-lit room that we complain when it's not bright enough. You follow what I'm saying? Like a ray of light is just a ray of light that makes us a little angry that it's not a full window of light. But then the darkness of a soul, where there are the dark nights and the dark days and the dark moments and the dark seasons, even a ray of light becomes a blazing sun. And see, I learned that from Colin. And so when my dark gets a little dark and I can still see, I no longer try to just take for granted the little ray of light. I try to see the ray of light as the blazing sun, because it's still a ray of light. See, it's an entering into the suffering and the pain of others that we learn how to deal with our own pain. See, there are two things I take away from these two texts of the suffering servant who entered into the suffering for us. Is that Jesus is the suffering servant. He takes upon himself our suffering and pain so that we have a chance of seeing a ray of light. But another takeaway is this. As followers of the suffering servant, we are to enter into the lives of the suffering as servants. That as we now have seen and witnessed and are experiencing that the suffering servant has suffered and he's taken on our sufferings and he's taken on our weaknesses, and we have decided that we believe in the Christian story, not the American story, not in the family story, not in the church's jacked up story, which that could be of his own story, not in my mama let me down or my dad let me down, or not my own stories of abuse, or not my stories of divorce, or not my stories of drugs and alcohol, not my past stories, but when I decide, if, when I decide, and each one of us have to make that decision, if I decide that the Christian story is the dominant narrative of my life, that that's the story I'm going to live in. And I see in that story that there was a God who refused to leave me in my suffering, who refused to leave me in my pain, who doesn't make me immune to it. I can't escape from it because the reign of sin and death is at work in this world. Jesus said it in John. He said, the ruler of this world is to come. Jesus knows that the enemy is at work as a ruler in this world, that the enemy, whatever the enemy is and whoever he is and whatever that means, that the reign of sin and death, that evil in this world has rulership, has sway in the world. And so all of our platitudes and all of our empty statements of God is in control now are challenged, actually theologically for once, that now the enemy is actually at work and has some control in the world, because that's happening all around us, because Collins is still walking the street homeless, because there are people like that in this world, because there's a continent starving of AIDS and starving of food in a world where we've got plenty of it on all levels, because of all those things still at work in the world, God himself still enters in and he still says to us, there is a ray of light. And you know it, Fred, you know it to be true because you know you're not held captive to your pain. You've shared in the redemptive pain of Collins. You've shared in the redemptive pain of others. You know it to be true. Now go do that. Go be that. Go see that. Go enter into that and take me with you. When that's my story, everything changes. But if my story is anything other than that story, then everything about me is vulnerable. And I can be held captive to my own pain and never enter the pain of others, but just be mad at everybody else for the pain that I have. And Paul knew this. What I appreciated about Paul is that he didn't explain away the pain. He didn't write a letter to the Ephesians that says, live your best life now, Apostle Paul. Like his letters would not have been bestsellers. This is what he said in 2 Corinthians 4, 7 through 18. Now we have this treasure in clay jars, so that this extraordinary power may be from God and not from us. We are afflicted in every way, but read this with me, but not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair. We are persecuted, but not abandoned. We are struck down, but not destroyed. Paul's not acting like everything's good, because that's not what followers of the suffering servant do. They don't act like the pain isn't there. We don't say, oh, it was all in God's timing. We don't say, oh, just give it to Jesus. We don't say, oh, just learn how to pray about it. He didn't say any of that. Paul was like, no, that sucks. That's horrible. That's hard. We are afflicted. We are perplexed. We are persecuted. We are struck down. I'm not going to explain it away. I'm not going to act like these things aren't happening. But then he says, but we're not crushed. We're not in despair. We're not abandoned. We're not destroyed. He's calling it what it is. But because it's framed within the narrative of the suffering servant, he's not giving pain permission to call it what it isn't. You understand? He's letting pain have permission to call it what it is. Affliction. Being perplexed. Persecution. Abandonment. Being struck down. But he's not giving pain permission to call it more than that. And look at what else he says. He says, we always carry the death of Jesus in our body, so that the life of Jesus may also be displayed in our body. For we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that Jesus' life may also be displayed in our mortal flesh. So then death is at work in us, life in you. Here's what I think he's saying. This is very poetic what Paul is doing. Here's what I think he's saying when he's saying that. We're always entering into suffering, because we're either suffering ourselves or we're entering into the suffering of others. But we enter in because we know that when we enter into the suffering and the pain of others, and when we embrace the pain that we feel, the redemptive life and light of Christ shines through. When we ignore the pain, that's when it takes us captive. when we try to scapegoat the pain, which we do so well in our society, and blame others for what we feel, that's when it takes us captive. But when we embrace it and call a spade, we call it what it is. That is when it no longer owns us, we own it. And so we're always feeling the residual effect of the reign of sin and death in the world. But we are not giving the residual effect of the reign of sin and death any kind of permission to have the final word, because the crucified and risen Christ has turned it upside down. Years ago, this church experienced a loss. We've experienced lots of losses. But years ago, there was a beautiful little girl born into this life, into the life of this church. And that little bitty girl did not live past the day. And I, like some of you, were there from start to the end. And as I was in a room with the mom and the dad and that little girl whose body was now lifeless because her life was now with God, the parents asked me if I wanted to hold her. And so I did. And as I'm holding this beautiful little body of this life that was all too short, but now does live on with God, the mother and the father looked at me, and the mother said, "What do we do?" And I said, "You scream at God. When you get home, you climb to the highest place of your house and you shake your hands at God. You don't ignore it. You don't brush it under the rug. You don't explain it away with simple theological truths that may or may not even be real. You go to God with every bit of your pain and your hurt, and you let Him have it. Because He can take it. Because the message of the suffering servant is that God hates the suffering more than we do. And she did. Again and again and again. And you know who met her in every scream and in every cry? The suffering servant met her there. And you don't explain that away. That's not a one and done. That pain has residual effect over the course of an entire life. There's not a birthday that goes by that I don't think of that little girl. Not a birthday since. That little girl changed my life. Because at that moment, the only thing I had, not only to receive as a Christ follower, but to give as a pastor, no words, no hope, just Jesus. Paul's not explaining this away. He gets to the end of it and says, "For we know that the one who raised the Lord Jesus will raise us with Jesus and present us with you. Indeed, everything is for your benefit, so that grace extends through more and more people, it may cause thanksgiving to increase to the glory of God. Therefore," say it with me, "we do not give up." Collins, did you ever want to give up? Why didn't you? Had you seen too much? Every time you walk by the train tracks of the bus station where many people in despair live and they lay their bodies across their tracks for their own way of getting rid of their own lives in this world, every time you saw that symbol of death, did it make you think twice? Does it still? But you had seen too much. You'd seen too much of God. Because he wasn't alone in his suffering. You're familiar with the man at the pool of Bethesda, right? Remember, there's this man, he has this infirmity for 30-something years. He goes to the pool, that's what it says. For 30 years, he goes to this pool. See, rumor has it that an angel will come and stir the pool up. And when the angel comes to stir the pool, if you get in the pool, the first one to get in the pool, I think, gets the healing. Y'all remember the story now? For 30-something years, the Bible tells us he went to this pool. 30-something years. What if that was the day he decided to give up? I mean, 30 years. Collins, how long were you living through homelessness? 30 years. 30 years this man goes year in, year out. I don't know how often. Year in, year out to the pool. 30 years. And he goes there. And the whole point is he needs help. And everybody walks around him and gets theirs. He could have blamed them. He could have been like, look, all you Yahweh worshiping people leaving me here at the pool. I come. You know I can't put myself in the pool. 30 years he goes. What if that was the day? What if that was the day he decided to stay in bed? I wouldn't have blamed him. I'd have been like, dude, you've done this for 30 years. Nobody gives a help. You go. Nobody cares. Just stay in bed, man. You've done this 30 years. Religious people stink. Just watching you. Nobody cares. What if that was the day he didn't miss Jesus? We don't give up. There has to be some pushback to the pain. See, there has to be some pushback to the pain. So Jesus looks at that man, and what does Jesus ask him? An insulting rhetorical question. Do you want to be made well? No, bro, I've just been showing up for 30 years, just, you know, because I like disappointment. It's like a This Is Us, you know, episode where it ends and leaves you hanging. I just like that every year. Yeah, I don't know why I brought that up, but that's just how I feel about the show. Here I am, I'm just showing up year in, year out. No. You know what Jesus, I think, is asking? I'm not really sure what he's asking, but what I think Jesus is asking is, I know you keep showing up, but now that you have the opportunity, do you really want it? Collins was faced with that question. Now that you have the opportunity, bro, do you really want this? That was the question. Do you want friends? Or do you want to be alone? Do you just want the stuff, the house, the goods? Or do you want the other things that are going to be far harder to deal with? See, because the fact of the matter is, some of us get so used to living in our pain that it's just too dang hard to get out of it. We just get accustomed to the scapegoating, accustomed to the anger. We've grown comfortable. We've grown familiar. And so the idea of pushing back is just not something we want to do because it's too exhausting. And that is when we need to remember that Christ is in that pushing back with us. Collins tested God over a washing machine. Remember that part of the story, y'all? If you didn't catch it, I'm not going to retell it. You have to listen to it on the podcast thing. But he, you know, missing a quarter. God, if you're real, then I'm going to come back to my washing machine and there's going to be a quarter on it. Ha! And there was a quarter. God's like, a quarter, really? I ain't got it. Bing! God is pushing back against our pain to make room for His presence. And some of us are holding on to it because it's just too comfortable and familiar. So to let it go is just too much. But what if we began to push back with Him? Go to the cycle, Dinah. I call this the cycle of redemptive pain. It's when the pain comes. And we live in the pain. For how long we have to live in the pain, I don't know. But there's got to come a point where we begin to push back on the pain. If we buy into the narrative of the suffering servant, there's got to be a point. And it can take 30 years. It can take however long it needs to take. But there has to be a point where we begin to push back against the pain, where the pain can no longer hold us captive. Because see, if the pain holds us captive, it becomes a very dangerous thing. It's like what C.S. Lewis said in The Problem of Pain. He said, mental pain is less dramatic than physical pain, but it is more common and also more hard to bear. The frequent attempt to conceal mental pain increases the burden. It is easier to say my tooth is aching than to say my heart is broken. It's just easier to not deal with that kind of pain. But at some point, the pain remains and it insists that it be dealt with. Because like C.S. Lewis also recognized in the same book, The Problem of Pain, he said, we can ignore even pleasure, but pain insists upon being attended to. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. It's in the pain where the voice of God is found as the loudest, because in our gut, we know it's not supposed to be this way. We know it's not supposed to feel this way. And if we hear the voice of God screaming through our pain, we then know there has to be something that can be done to our pain. And it is the suffering servant that has entered in and already taken on our pains upon himself, saying, you know, that wasn't a one and done transaction. I will still take your pains. I will still send people to you, did he not, Collins? I will still send people into your life. When you least expect it, I will still show up. And when you least expect it, one of my children may say, do you want a friend? One of my children may invite you over. One of my children may have a word for you. Some of my children may come together and say, we will take care of that with you. We will shoulder that pain alongside of you. Now, why is that? Why should it work that way? Because, now go back to the slide of the Corinthian text, Anna, sorry. Because Paul said so. He said this is how it should work. 2 Corinthians 1, 3-7. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of all mercies, and the God of all comfort. He comforts us in all our afflictions so that we may be able to, read it with me, comfort those who are in any kind of affliction through the comfort we ourselves received from God. Because we know the healing of the suffering servant. I've never been an adult man living through homelessness. When my mom and dad didn't have a place to live and we had to live with my grandmother, I did not feel the chronic stress that my dad must have felt, the trauma that my mom and dad must have felt moving through that. I was just a child. But I have felt my own share of pain. That when I know the healing touch of the suffering servant and I see the pain in others, I am invited to enter in, and with the comfort I've received, offer just comfort too. And comfort doesn't come in the form of empty phrases of, well, everything happens for a reason, or in God for the good of God's glory, any of those unhelpful, unsensitive, frankly, bad theology phrases. It comes instead in the form of presence, which is what the word comfort means. Comfort is mentioned 5 times. Nerd moment. In the Greek, comfort means paraklesis. You know what paraklesis is? It's the same Greek word used for the Spirit of God in John. In other words, paraklesis literally means to come alongside. To comfort someone is to come alongside them. It's not to stand at a distance and throw money at it. It doesn't say do benevolence. It says do comfort. The church isn't called to benevolence. The church is called to comfort. Anybody can stroke a check, but not only Christians will be willing to stroke out time and emotion and ongoing and perpetuity relationship and presence. It's with the comfort we've received that we enter in to bring comfort into others. Collins, did you ever feel alone? But were you ever really alone? Did you know that then? But do you know it now? All we ever did was join God in that work. He had never left Collins, despite what Collins felt. All we did was became signposts, witnesses, say witnesses, witnesses of the reality that in the Christian story, God was not absent in his pain. What about you, though? See, God isn't absent in your pain either. But if you and I aren't willing to admit that we have it, well, listen to the words of Richard Rohr. If we cannot find a way to make our wounds into sacred wounds, we invariably become cynical, negative, or bitter. This is the storyline of many of the greatest novels, myths, and stories of every culture. If we do not transform our pain, we will most assuredly transmit it, usually to those closest to us, our family, our neighbors, our coworkers, and invariably the most vulnerable, our children. See, what we find is even the risen Christ bore the wounds of pain in his nail-scarred hands and spear-pierced side. Even after God brings healing, we will still carry the wounds. But to what end? To what end, church? To what end do we carry the wounds? So that others can see the wounds and be set free. So that others can see the wounds and be set free. When Jesus showed Thomas the wounds, what did it do for Thomas? It set him free. I've been asked, why do I share my story with people? Why have I shared with you all the things that I've shared with you over the last 8 years? It's not because I like to. Collins, why do you share your story? Do you love getting up in the morning going, I can't wait to tell everybody that I was homeless? Why do you do it? Who? How? Does it help you? How? You're no longer owned by your story. You own it, don't you? You're no longer taken captive by your pain. You own it. Next slide. When we move from pain to pushback, we give our pain permission to exist. We no longer explain it away. And when we do that, we take permission over our pain. You understand that? We take permission away from our pain and over our pain. It no longer holds us captive. But only when we give it permission to at least exist. And when we do that, we prayerfully place that pain where it belongs in the story of our lives. It's a part of my story, and I can't run from it, nor should I, because maybe by revealing that part of my story, someone else's story may meet Christ there. And in the prayerful placement of that pain, a passion begins to evolve. A transformation of, now I cannot stand idly by while that pain persists in front of me and not say something about it. Not do something about it. And that gives me purpose. A purpose to my existence, a purpose to that pain, and that's what makes pain redemptive, is when the wounds become sacred, life-giving wounds, not wounds of guilt, not wounds of shame, not pain of guilt, not pain of shame, but pain where sacred things happen because sacred things have happened because the suffering servant of the sacred things has entered into my pain. And so to close, Paul says this later on in the same chapter. As he was bringing his pain before God again and again, he said, concerning this pain, this thing he had going on, he said, I pleaded with the Lord 3 times that it would leave me, but he said to me, read it with me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is perfected in weakness. The word perfected means matured. Say matured, or say complete. Perfected is not a good word for our little English vocabulary. It's because of the freight that's associated with it. My power is matured in your weakness. He said, therefore, I will most gladly boast all the more about my weakness so that Christ's power may reside in me. So I take pleasure in weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and in difficulties for the sake of Christ. Read it with me. For when I am weak, then I am strong. If you and I want healing into our pains, we have to admit that the pains are what they are. We have to push back against those pains in order to take permission over the pain, to prayerfully place it in our lives where it belongs, allow it to stir a holy passion by which we find a purpose to enter into the pain of others so that they then can find the strength to push back, so that they then can take permission over the pain and find its prayerful place in their lives, so that they then can turn around and find a holy passion that gives them purpose so that they too will enter into the pain. You see where I'm going? And that is why Collins has been trained as a PRS, peer recovery support specialist. That's why he's been trained as a servant leader coordinator. That's why Collins is going to lead our 3E restoration ministry, because Collins is walking around the redemptive cycle, the cycle of redemptive pain. And so too can we. And every week we come, man, every week we come, we gather at this table. We gather at the table where the pain was dealt with. We gather at the table where we're free to bring our pains. If you've been at this church for any length of time, you know that the one thing we do not do is explain away pain. We do not hide pain. We bring our pain to one another so that one another, and with one another's shoulders and hands, we can bring it to Christ. There's no living a death by a thousand cuts in this church. There's no living a life of quiet desperation in this church. That cannot happen here, because we can't bring it to the table when we're ignoring it all the time. Bring it to the table. The bread, the body of Christ, the cup, the blood of Jesus, bring it to the table. He waits for you. He welcomes you here.